Welcome to Psych Pearls podcast by Psychiatric Times. With thoughtful insights into the world of psychiatry, this podcast provides timely clinical commentary and practical cutting-edge pearls for you and your practice. We hope you enjoy it.
Hello, I'm Paul Gleason with Psychiatric Times. Our guest today is Dr. Helen Lavretsky. She is a professor in residence in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of California, Los Angeles. Her work on geriatric depression and integrative mental health using mind-body interventions has received national attention, and she has won numerous grants supporting that work. A distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association and a fellow of the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology, she's also on the board of Psychiatric Times. Dr. Lavretsky, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me here.
All right. Now, one of the big stories in geriatric mental health right now is the drug aducanumab. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved it for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease in June to both cheers and jeers. On the one hand, it's the first potentially disease-modifying agent for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease, which has excited some caregivers and clinicians. But critics have argued that the data did not demonstrate that aducanumab slowed cognitive decline. After its approval, three FDA board members resigned in protest, and the FDA recently narrowed its prescribing information. So, Dr. Lavretsky, help us think through this from a clinician's perspective. What are the most important issues in this debate over the drug's approval, and how can clinicians make sense of those issues?
Well, the plot thickens because yesterday two healthcare systems, Cleveland Clinics and Mount Sinai, decided not to use the drug. And several insurances announced that they will not cover it, which will limit the use of the drug because of the prohibitive costs of $56,000 per year, large copays, as well as the cost of PET scans and MRIs required to be performed twice in a year for the follow-up of side effects. And in addition, the FDA requested an external review of its approval process. So at this point, I would say the future of the drug is a little bit unclear how it's going to be used. But patients are calling, and they would like to use the drug because this is a really hopeless end-of-life disease that doesn't have a cure or a solution, easy solution. So families, caregivers, and patients are trying to catch any opportunity to improve upon their prognosis and their disease course. And so this drug is a monoclonal antibody that is acting against amyloid beta, which is one of the proposed mechanisms of Alzheimer's disease. And so the drug would use by clearing amyloid beta. And what is not known at this point is whether this clearance will lead to improvement in clinical and cognitive and functional symptoms of the disease. So far, and that's what the controversy is coming from, because what has been documented was the drug, its ability to clear amyloid, reduce the amount of the amyloid by about 40% at the highest dose, which was more common in APOE4 carriers. That's what's known. The population that was included in the trials wasn't broad. It was narrowly defined as amyloid positive MCI or mild Alzheimer's disease patients with the mini mental state examination score cutoff of 24. And that's another source of the controversy, because the initial approval of the drug was broadly for Alzheimer's disease, not just for this population. And so the infusions start at the low dose and increase every 2 months until they reach about 10 milligrams per kilogram. And so, as I said, they would require MRI scans being performed at the 7th and 12th months during monthly infusions. The most severe adverse events include brain swelling, headaches, microbleeds, and falls. And as I said, Medicare and insurance companies has yet to establish the percentage of the coverage, whether they will cover it completely. So all in all, it will probably likely to be used by those who can afford the drug.
Right. I mean, as you said, though, lots of people will want it. I mean, I'm sure that as clinicians, they will see patients, families, caregivers, all trying to get this drug. So what advice would you have about not only what patients are most likely to benefit, but also how should clinicians help patients understand the drug, maybe manage expectations, and do all the rest of that?
I would say in the face of the controversy, I would restrict the use of the drug to this narrowly defined population. And please understand that you would have to use PET neuroimaging biomarkers and or CSF and blood peripheral biomarkers of amyloid to monitor the progression of the disease. So the patients and caregivers have to be prepared for this really cumbersome, very hands-on management. And the cost has to be disclosed up front.
Definitely. And, you know, you've talked a little bit about prognosis and side effects. How much do we know about that so far with aducanumab?
Well, we only have knowledge from this ongoing trials. So the approval of the drug is provisional pending phase 4 trial, from which we would know that has a placebo arm, from which we would know what to expect in terms of side effects and more prolonged experience with the drug. But so far, we don't know what the long-term effects on the brain would be from the removal of amyloid. You know, given the side effects of brain swelling and microbleeds, it may have some deleterious effect in the long term. So patients and caregivers should be probably prepared to, first of all, face this unknown long-term side effects.
Right. And, you know, so much is unknown about aducanumab, but of course, there are other treatment options. And I was wondering if you could speak a bit about how this drug might fit into the existing pharmacological options for Alzheimer's disease. You know, what treatments might it replace and what should it definitely not replace?
Well, this is a revolutionary drug, the first drug in the disease modifying cohort of drugs that are coming down the pipeline. It will join a small family of the drugs that are already approved for symptomatic treatment like memantine and donepezil. And a combination of disease-modifying drugs, lifestyle strategies, and drugs like memantine and donepezil is probably a fair combination. And that's what we will see in the future. There are actually some trials ongoing that look at the different drugs already, combination of the drugs that target different points of cascade of amyloid production and tau mechanism. So ideally, when we get tau drugs ready, it will be probably a combination of amyloid and tau drugs plus symptomatic drugs plus behavioral management.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about kind of those drugs on the horizon. I mean, I know that at the end of June, the FDA gave a breakthrough therapy designation to donanemab, if I have that pronounced right. How do these drugs in the pipeline, how are they similar or different from aducanumab?
Donanemab is very, very similar in terms of affecting amyloid plaques and clearing expected effect on clearance. It is known to have a more of a immune response to the drug because it was developed on the mice cell lines. And so it has similar profile in terms of side effects with brain swelling and microbleeds and headaches. So they're in a way, mechanism-wise, they're very similar, although they were produced by different mechanisms. So these two drugs are similar, but there are other drugs in the pipeline that would differ by the mechanism.
Do any seem especially promising to you, granted that we're very early in the process?
No, I'm afraid to say anything promising at the moment. They will increase, so none of them are offering a cure. And so it would be a similar kind of effect of delayed progression. How much delayed, 10 to 40%, is it relevant to families? Probably yes. If you could delay the progression by 40%, that's a substantial improvement. The question is, So at this point, we're more sure about what they do in the tissue or in the brain. We're less sure about behavioral and cognitive aspects of the effect or overall benefit. So that's to be continued, and we have to learn about that. But I think all in all, with the progress of this disease-modifying treatments, we'll see an overall improvement of the delay of progression. And the earlier you start, like, for example, these drugs are approved for MCI and early dementia, the longer time people would have in terms of well-being and maintaining their independence.
You know, earlier you mentioned, you know, of course, the sort of overall clinical treatment of Alzheimer's and dementia, and pharmaceuticals are not our only options. And I know that you've done a lot of research on sort of non-pharmaceutical treatments. Is there any new research on non-pharmacological options that's caught your eye recently?
So we're getting more and more. There are lots of ongoing trials and completed trials now that firmly now demonstrate that improved physical activity and social engagement and mental stimulation and stress management, and especially management of vascular health like blood pressure and cholesterol and diabetes, obesity, sleep apnea, can improve and prevent cognitive decline, which is really a substantial help for us physicians in terms of how we approach our patients. So what I do in my clinic, integrative psychiatry clinic or geriatric psychiatry clinic, I review lifestyle preferences and practices of the patient and in the family of caregivers, and review exercise, diet, what they do, activities, daily activities, what they do for mental stimulation, for joyous activities, which is a mainstay of my approach to treatment. Everybody has to experience joy once a day at least. Stress management and management of vascular risk factors. So all of this diet, you know, included, and supplements, the use of supplements. So that's what I do for my patients in my daily practice. In terms of the diet, there are some advances, like this MIND diet demonstrated some promise. And MIND diet is a combination of Mediterranean and DASH diet, administering to reduce blood pressure, reduce salt. And that uses basically plant-based diet, leafy green vegetables, berries, whole grains, fish, poultry, and beans in small portions. And so that's also shown to delay progression of Alzheimer's disease. Loneliness, in the days of COVID, of course, loneliness is a global pandemic of a sort, and it really affects older adults and those with cognitive impairments. So making sure that they have some kind of social contact, support from families or mental health professionals would be important in terms of preventing stress-related cognitive decline or depression-related cognitive decline. So this is also an important assessment tool for clinicians.
I have to circle back to the issue of joy. You know, how does a clinician prescribe joy? How do you talk to your patients about that?
Okay, so I ask them what brings them joy, because people are very different in what they enjoy doing, you know. So it doesn't help for me, let's say I'm a yoga practitioner, to say to everybody, you practice yoga 10 to 15 minutes a day, because nobody will, or very few will. So I ask them, what brings you joy? And it varies quite a bit, you know. Some enjoy, of course, older adults enjoy seeing their grandchildren. So I prescribe visits, you know, like, I send people to the beach as a part of the prescription. You know, I live in Los Angeles. So walking, being in nature or walking with bare feet on the ground, grounding, is a source of joy for us human, from which we are kind of disconnected living in large cities. So I actually prescribe connecting to nature or finding a tree to hug or finding a piece of green grass or something like this, enjoying sunset, sunrise, being outside, regulating sleep, music, dance, expressing art, anything that, but it would be very individualized. So it's very important to know what your patients like. spend some time asking about this.
And in terms of their efficacy, you know, I'm wondering about how does the efficacy of these sort of non-pharmaceutical options compare to the efficacy of the pharmaceutical options we have for Alzheimer's or other late life cognitive issues?
Well, you know, so there have been treatment trials of cognitive stimulation and exercise that sometimes find and sometimes don't, like drugs, effects on cognition. What they do is to improve quality of life that drugs may not do, actually. So you do prescribe drugs and it brightens their awareness of the world, but do they really enjoy it? So unless you add content to your therapy, just prescribing drugs will not make any sense. There must be improvement in the quality of life, adding life to years, not years to life, you know.
That's a good way to think about it. I like that a lot. And speaking of sort of adding years, that makes me think of what's in the future. So I'm wondering what your hopes for the future of Alzheimer's treatment will be. Where do you think we'll be in 10 or 20 years?
I do think that the treatment of Alzheimer's disease will improve in terms of outcomes and the quality of life. What I think is most important is to start as early as childhood, school, to trying to prevent Alzheimer's disease. In fact, it might have to start in utero of their mothers, you know, with healthy lifestyle, stress reduction, learning something like yoga and having tools for stress reducing. Because stress is a common denominator of all aging-related disease, including Alzheimer's disease, like inflammation. Campaigns informing general public about the role of nutrition. You know, like processed food is really bad for your brain. Brain health-oriented campaigns directed toward families with young children. We're now understanding, similar to what was done with smoking campaigns, and now obesity, then sedentary lifestyle, then nutrition, you know, public has to really understand what they're after in order to leave, not expect a miracle of trying to clear amyloid when you're 80 versus participating actively in your own health and trying to prevent accumulating amyloid when you're 80.
So, I mean, one major thing it sounds like you're looking for is increased awareness that brain health is not only an issue for older adults, but that in order to have good brain health as an older adult, got to start early. That's fascinating. I sure hope those campaigns happen. And, you know, as we conclude our time together, let's go from broad to very narrow. If you could share one important clinical tip or piece of advice with your colleagues, you know, what would it be?
Take care of caregivers, including ourselves, because ultimately the health and well-being of our patients will depend on well-being of their caregivers, including ourselves. All inclusive. We're in it together. So right. Self-care is not optional. It's a must.
I hope everyone listens to this, goes and takes care of themselves for the rest of the day. And that's all the time we have. So thank you again, Dr. Lavretsky, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me here.